were all caught asleep. He flicked his lightsaber blade up, slicing through the first intruder's weapon. Fast as an attacking slash rat, the rifleman stepped back in a crouch, drawing and firing a holstered blaster in a single practiced move. Jason tapped the bolt out of the way with a negligent readjustment of his lightsaber blade, then thrust, shoving the blade through the man's armor at the shoulder. Jason felt it penetrate the armor, burn its way through flesh and bone beneath, and emerge from the armor on the other side. The man screamed and fell, dragging his body off Jason's weapon. Jason glanced left. Mara's foe was falling, a smoking line from shoulder blade to stomach, marking the injury that had defeated him. Beyond, Luke was in the midst of four enemies, all of them firing. The oversized bolt from one of their weapons, missing wildly, flashed toward Mara and Jason, and the two Jedi ducked out of its way. At the end of his spin, Luke stood up, and something fell away from each of his attackers. A rifle barrel, an arm, a severed head. Three of them fell down. The fourth cast his destroyed weapon to the floor, raised his hands, then oddly followed his companions to the floor, his body limp. Han and Leia snuggled together on the couch, sitting in the darkness, wordlessly watching the galaxy rotate outside beyond the viewport. The door to the passageway hissed open behind them, spilling light into the large room. Han and Leia turned to look. Four armored figures marched in, quiet and confident. Apparently not noticing the Solos on the couch, they walked straight to the doorway leading to the main bedchamber. The one with the largest weapon, a shoulder-mounted blaster rig, set up to destroy the door, while the other three readied their own weapons. Han and Leia exchanged a puzzled look. Leia shrugged. Han drew his blaster. "Hey," he said. The four turned. One, fastest on the uptake, began to aim more quickly than the others. Han shot him in the throat. Leia sprang up from the couch, a force-assisted leap that carried her toward the ceiling of the tall living chamber. She lit her lightsaber on the way up. One of the intruders, the one carrying the shoulder-mounted blaster, aimed at her. Han, not knowing whether her skills and lightsaber could deflect the blast from such a weapon, shot him too, his blaster bolt burning its way into the side of the man's helmet. The other two fired at him. The first shot hit the back of the sturdy couch and picked the furniture up, spinning it toward the outer wall. Han and the couch hit the transparasteel of the viewport. He heard Leia's lightsaber hum and sizzle. He rolled out from under the furniture. In the moment it took him to come upright, blaster in hand, the situation was resolved. One of the two remaining attackers was down with his head off. The other, shaking in pain, was missing both arms at the elbow. Both of Han's targets were down, smoke rising from where the blaster bolts had hit them. Leia turned her attention to the door, and Han didn't need Jedi powers to know what she was thinking.
"Yeah," he said. "You left, me right."
They emerged into Calabarth Way at a dead run, Han turning toward the chambers of the Corellian delegation, Leia turning toward the delegation from Coruscant. The first door Han passed slid open, and a man leapt out. Han aimed, wrenched his blaster back out of line. The man emerging was his own son. "Come on, kid," he said, and ran past. Han could see up ahead that the double-wide door leading into the Corellian delegation suite was open. As he watched, a black-armored figure staggered back through the doorway, his chest smoking from what looked like blaster hits, and swung his oversized blaster rifle into line back toward the doorway. Han fired. His shot hit the attacker's armor just under the armpit, staggering him, but not penetrating. At the same moment, Jason hurled his lightsaber. It spun in flight, catching the attacker as he was still off balance from Han's shot, crossing him at knee level and severing both legs at the joint. Jason put on a burst of force-augmented speed, leaving his father behind, and kept the lightsaber spinning in the air just outside the suite's door. There were more flashes of light from that chamber, more small arms fire, and he took the last two steps with a sinking feeling. He snatched the hilt of his spinning lightsaber out of the air and stepped into the doorway. The room was on fire. No, that wasn't quite right. Three members of the Corellian security detail were on fire, their bodies burning briskly, smoke also curling up from their blasters. Oddly, the chamber's fire alert had not activated. There were three bodies on the ground that weren't smoking. They were black-clad intruders. One of the interior doors was gone, wrenched free, the frame scorched by the power of the intruders' blaster rifles. In the doorway stood Wedge Antilles, dressed in his shorts and ancient Rebel Alliance shirt, a blaster in his hand. He looked Jason in the eye and shook his head, a sorrowful gesture. Jason entered and moved past Wedge. On the floor of the sumptuous bedchamber beyond lay Five-World Prime Minister Adele Saxon, a burned-edge hole the size of a dinner plate passing entirely through her torso, residual charring masking any expression she might have been wearing when she died. Leia sped faster as she neared the door to the main Coruscant delegation quarters. Those doors were open, and she could hear blaster fire from beyond them. As she reached the doorway, she dropped the speed burst and stopped with the abruptness of a Toydarian junk merchant flying over a credit. The chamber beyond, an antechamber providing access to a variety of bedchambers and function rooms, was filled with smoke and bodies. Three of the downed combatants were black-armored intruders. Several were GA security. One, on the far side of the room, sitting half upright, was an elderly man in an admiral's uniform. His head, neck, and the top portion of his chest were missing, the edges of what remained blackened by high energy. A huge hole in the wall above, centered at the 2-meter level, showed where the upper reaches of his body had been when the blast had hit. Nearer, a fourth black-armored intruder was sprawled on the floor, his blaster rifle a meter beyond his reach. He struggled to rise, but another GA-uniformed officer straddled his body, gripping his helmet by the faceplate. As the intruder continued to struggle, the officer brought a small blaster pistol up to the back of his neck and fired down through the spine. The attacker jerked and lay still. The officer became aware that someone was standing behind him. He spun and aimed, and as he turned, Leia recognized him as Tycho Selchu. The old pilot's friend or foe recognition was still incredibly quick. He brought his aim off Leia even as she raised her blade to deflect a possible shot. Leia looked past him to the body against the wall.
"Oh, no," she said. "Not Pelion."
Tycho shook his head.
"Not Pelion?"
"My double."
The voice came from a shadowy doorway. Its door was opened, not destroyed. From it stepped the old admiral, dressed in a dark robe, a blaster rifle in his hands. Tycho asked,
"Is Han?"
"He's fine," Leia said. "Han shot first." "He looked at me," Luke said. "Foamed at the mouth and fell dead."
"The one Jason crippled did the same thing," Wedge said.
"I saw foam on the lips of several of them," Pelion added.
They were crowded into a lounge near the Solo suite. Representatives of both diplomatic parties, all the Jedi, and a few Toryaz station security officers.
"Since there's only one party here that's plausibly neutral," Wedge said, "I propose we hand coordination of this situation over to Master Skywalker and his Jedi."
"I agree," Pelion said. "Which is not to say that I only want Jedi looking into it."
"Don't worry," Luke said. "I'll be happy to draw on everyone's strengths." He frowned. "Who's going to take over as Five-World Prime Minister? Saxon's deputy?"
Wedge nodded. "Fellow named Denjax Templar, once married to Saxon, in fact. They parted but remained friendly. He'll hold the post until they can arrange a new election. Months, perhaps."
Han snorted.
"You mean until he gets killed, too?"
"All right," Luke said. "If I'm in charge of this investigation, a circumstance that can only last until the GA and Corellian delegations receive orders from their respective governments, then I'm going to have to act fast." Throughout the night, when diplomats should have been asleep or planning the next day's negotiations, the Jedi and other investigators scoured pertinent areas of the Narsak habitat. Wedge and Tycho discovered that a shuttle had docked and departed just minutes before the assault on the diplomatic envoys had begun. They also confirmed with the frigate Firethorn that the same shuttle had departed another habitat at about the same time the assault on the diplomatic envoys was beginning. Hyperdrive equipped, it had headed away from Kuat and her gravity well at a rate that did not elicit suspicion, and it had entered hyperspace before the first alarms were transmitted from the habitat. Leia and Mara arranged for security operatives familiar with forensics to be brought in to examine the bodies of the attackers. All had been killed either by trauma from blasters or lightsabers, or through the introduction of a powerful alkaloid poison administered by small injectors in their mouths. Preliminary evidence was that each of them had already been dying from incurable illness as well, and a simple genetics test offered the probability that 3/4 or more of the attackers were Corellian.
Wedge and Tycho, accompanied by Luke, acquired a shuttle and a sophisticated set of comm sensor gear from Lieutenant Yorvin. After an hour's careful flying out from the station, they homed in on the signal being broadcast by Captain Tauwaller's comlink. Tauwaller, stone dead, victim of explosive decompression, was still in possession of that comlink. Jason, Ben in tow, wandered throughout the habitat, seeking additional impressions that might point to the use of the Force. He found them in the auxiliary security chamber, now occupied by Lieutenant Yorvin, and in the airlock where Tauwaller had died. In each case, there was a female aspect to the impressions, but Jason could get no clear sense of them. The harder he looked, the more they seemed to blur. Mara and Leia ran a thorough examination of the security auxiliary control room, finding the code modifications that had allowed the shuttle to maneuver into position without being detected by the base sensors. They were able to dig out the true recordings, showing the shuttle's arrival and quick departure. Luke and his investigators assembled in the lounge again, at about the hour they would have been waking up. No one looked weary. The Jedi sustained themselves through Force techniques, while Han, Wedge, and Tycho relied on calf and stubbornness. "So what have we learned?" Luke asked. "This was a sophisticated plan, at least in its setup. The planner knew exactly where everyone was sleeping, or rather was supposed to be sleeping, since Admiral Pellion and his personnel occupied different chambers without informing the base security detail. Captain Tauwaller appears to have been influenced, both into participating in the plan and into killing himself, by means of use of the Force. Meaning that, regretfully, we have to conclude that a rogue Jedi or equivalent is involved. Supporting that point is the fact that the weapons they carried were designed for use against Jedi." Wedge interrupted. "Much the way the Corellian response to some recent missions was optimized against Jedi." Before Luke could reply, Han cut in.
"It was Thraken."
"That's one possibility," Luke admitted.
"Possibility nothing," Han's voice rose. "Does anybody here not know that it was my boy Jason and Luke's boy Ben who wrecked Centerpoint Station?"
Silence fell in the wake of those words. Luke leaned back. "We'll investigate the Thraken angle, of course. Anything else?"
"I've got something," Jaina said.
From beneath her outer robe, she produced a folded packet of orange cloth, a bit larger than her fist. She carefully unfolded it and held it out so that the others could see its contents. At first, Luke couldn't grasp what he was looking at. It seemed to be something organic, the dried fruit of a mutant tree. It was a pliant thing with a blue-black central core, perhaps a dozen centimeters long. From that core sprang 20 or more tubular branches, narrowest where they were attached to the core and at their tips, only slightly thicker in their centers, each about 6 centimeters long, and each bearing colors, stripes, and other patterns. One, lumpy and knotted, consisted of red and blue stripes in a spiral pattern. Another was straight, an eye-hurting yellow with flecks of red and black. A third was a creamy tan with jittery, jagged markings in black. "We found this in the airlock that Tauwaller used when he was going out for fresh air," Jaina said. "I haven't had time to scan it for inorganic toxins, but there's no biological activity going on in it. It just seems to be beadwork."
"Accidentally dropped, or left for us to find?" Luke asked. "Carried by Tauwaller or someone else?"
Jaina shrugged.
"No way to tell."
"Excuse me."
The words came from overhead and all around, a set of public address speakers. Luke recognized the voice of Lieutenant Yorvin, a Toriaz Station security officer.
"I have a priority holocom contact coming in for Admiral Pellion."
"I'm here,"
Pellion said. He heaved himself to his feet, and Tycho stood too.
"That'll be the crack of dawn report any changes call, and as soon as I report, this conference is done."
He sighed.
"I'll be back in a few minutes."
He walked stiffly from the room, and the door closed behind him and Tycho. Wedge consulted his chrono.
"The Prime Minister will be receiving one of those too, if you'll excuse me."
He rose and departed as well.
"Leaving only Jedi?" Zek said. "And Jedi in law."
Han scowled at him. Luke stared at the others over his hands, which he held steepled before him in a meditative pose.
"I think we can safely say that our mission at this station has been an utter failure. We've been outmaneuvered, and we have at least one enemy we didn't know about before, and we know very little about now."
In a few minutes, the delegations will be recalled. It'll be time for Jedi investigations to get underway for real. Jason, Ben, please see what you can find out about Captain Tauwaller. We need to find out about the Force user he apparently had contact with. She can't have left no trace. If you can't pick up a trail, continue with the shuttle she apparently escaped on.
Jason nodded.
Consider it done. Jaina, Zek, I want you to find out whatever you can about that tassel you found. Try to determine whether it was left accidentally or deliberately, where it came from, what it means. When that's done, please return to the task force at Corellia and take command of Hardpoint Squadron until Mara and I get back from our groundside mission. Leia, Han, I'd like to ask you to continue trying to calm things down between Corellia and the GA. Mara and I will travel on to Corellia to see what we can find out about the possible origins of the assault made against us today. All right, let's go. Once the Skywalkers were out the door, Jason gestured to get his sister's attention, to keep her from following Zek and the other Jedi. Can I see that thing again?
Sure.
She held the tassel out to him. Jason looked it over. Close up, the mystery object proved to be an unusual example of beadcraft. It seemed to be a set of decorative tassels, each shaped and colored in an entirely different pattern, each attached to the longer central strand. One of the tassels continued to draw his eye, the tan one, with the jagged black markings. Tiny black threads escaped through its surface, poking out from between the close-set beads. Viewed from the distance of a meter, they made the tassel look as though it needed a shave. But on closer inspection, they resembled tiny claws. He became aware that Jaina was still speaking, her words lost in his distraction. He smiled at her and shook his head. Sorry, I was daydreaming.
That's not like you.
More like Anakin.
Listen, would you like to trade?
Jaina frowned.
Trade what?
Assignments. I'm feeling something from these tassels.
Can you?
No, not really. She stooped to look them over more closely, then shook her head.
So I should be the one to investigate them.
You look into Tauwaller, then go and take command of Uncle Luke's squadron.
Coronet Corellia.
Using false identities, Luke and Mara cleared Corset Customs without any trouble. Outside the security building, they kissed, put up the hoods of their traveler's robes, and went their separate ways. Mara fetched an airspeeder she'd rented under her assumed name and sped off toward a series of meetings where she'd pick up supplies and information she needed for her mission. Luke, his day's activities as urgent but not as time-critical, waved down a public transportation ground speeder and directed it to an address in one lightly trafficked area of the government districts of Coronet. The building that was his destination, actually three buildings down from the address he'd given the driver and where he exited the transport, was simple of design and pleasing to the eye. It was very low, one story only on its right and left wings, but swept upward toward the middle in a steep curve so that its center was a narrowing spire several stories in height. On the fence gate was a printed sign reading, "Closed during planetary emergency. For help or information, please contact Corellian Security." A uniformed Corsec officer walked the sidewalk in front of the fence, keeping her eye on pedestrian and speeder traffic. Luke walked past the Corsec officer, not making eye contact. Once Luke was well past her, almost to the corner where the fence changed from plasteel to smooth stone and marked the beginning of a city library property, he glanced back. The Corsec woman was facing away. Another few steps and she'd turn and begin pacing back in Luke's direction. He took a quick look and feel around, detected no one's attention on him, and leapt over the fence. He came down, rolling to his feet almost silently, and dashed to the cover of the bushes alongside of the small Jedi enclave. Luke stopped at a window, looked around again, and brought out his comlink. He changed frequencies to one routinely used by Jedi on field operations, then whistled three notes into it. The window hissed as it unsealed. Luke pulled at the window from the bottom. It remained attached, hinged at the top, and rolled through it, coming up on his feet in what looked like a small schoolroom beyond. The window sealed itself shut behind him. The room was darkened, but not dark. The only sound to be heard was the hum of the Enclave's air-cooling machinery.
He moved to the door. It didn't slide open at his approach. He gripped the edge and gave it a shove. It slid aside on well-lubricated rails. Just beyond it, a silver lightsaber blade snap-hissed into life. The man who carried it said,
"You're gonna find it hard to loot with both your arms cut off."
Luke grinned.
"That's quite a greeting, Corrin." The other Jedi turned his lightsaber off just as quickly as he'd powered it on.
"Luke, Master Skywalker!"
He stepped forward into the faint light admitted by the doorway. Corrin Horn was about Luke's age and height, but a bit stockier of build, broader in the shoulder. Grandson of a famous Corellian Jedi of the Old Republic era, he'd come into recognition and training of his Jedi powers even later than Luke had. He wasn't dressed as a Jedi now. He wore anonymous blue and white pinstripe coveralls, spattered with grease and hydraulic fluids, and a set of welder's goggles pushed up on his forehead. As he held out his hand for Luke, he looked like a pit mechanic ready to explain just how much his hyperdrive repairs were going to cost. Luke took his hand, an embrace of brothers in arms. "How's your family?"
"Good."
Korn's voice suggested he wasn't entirely happy.
"Mirax is under house arrest. Quite a flap over that, too. Some in the government want her expertise in smuggling critical materials into the system. Others don't trust her because she's married to a Jedi. So she waits at home under arrest, every need being catered to by government personnel, enjoying a vacation."
He snorted.
"As for Valen and Gisela, well, I suspect you'd know better than I would what they're up to."
Luke nodded. Corrin and Mirax's children were both Jedi, raised as much by the teachers of the Jedi Academy as by their biological parents, off doing the business of the Order. Corrin's face softened.
"Thanks for not using them on the Corellian missions."
"That was an easy decision," Luke said. Corrin gestured down the hallway toward the rear of the Enclave.
"I've set up one of the bolt holes as a staging area. Your lightsaber components are there. Also clothes, supplies, and credits."
Mara decided that Thrakken Sal Solo's surroundings quite expressively reflected his mentality. He had a bunker mentality. He lived in a bunker. Perhaps he'd had more aesthetic sense in a prettier dwelling in the past, but if so, he had purged that weakness in his personality in recent years. Thrakken's estate, as unlovely as any Mara had ever seen in the possession of a major political figure, was a flat sheet of land a kilometer west of Coronet's government precincts. There were several doors at ground level, all sideways sliding slabs of blue-green durasteel. Two of them large enough to accommodate speeders, but there were no visible windows. The estate was ringed by a high, gray duracrete wall, not too high for a Jedi Master to jump, but certainly high enough to silhouette a leaping intruder quite nicely. Mara knew from intelligence reports that there were pressure and movement sensors installed at random intervals under the ground cover, that the exterior holocams fed into monitors in Thrakken's security chamber, as well as the decorative wall displays of the rooms, that the complex had its own generators should city power lines be cut. Mara had set up on the roof of a building across a broad but lightly traveled avenue from Thrakken's estate. Full darkness fell, and a tiny green dot appeared halfway up the squashed dome of Thrakken's home. It remained there for half a minute, and then disappeared. Mara checked to make sure her lightsaber and other equipment were in place. Then she rolled over the lip of the roof and fell two stories to the sidewalk, landing as lightly as a leaf fluttering to the ground. She held herself in a crouch, her dark robes making her all but invisible, and waited until there was no speeder cross traffic to be seen. She came up out of her crouch like a sprinter and was across the avenue and up against the base of the featureless duracrete wall a moment later. A quick flex of the legs and boost of the force, and she was atop that wall. Not quite. She did not allow herself to come down on the wall top. Instead, she caught herself with the force, creating a bubble between her and the top of the wall, and drifted just over that surface until she was above the blue clover on the far side. She allowed herself to float down to stand just above the blue clover. The bubble of force energy that kept her aloft was easier to maintain when she was mere centimeters above the surface. Merely having the mental image, the paradigm of it as a sort of air-filled balloon improved her ability to perceive it, to maintain it. At the base of the wall, she stood a moment, eyes closed and focused on the other things she'd have to do to cross 200 meters of sensor-filled open space. air. She could not keep air from moving, of course. As she moved, she would displace it. But she added motion to the air she displaced, so that it moved out in a single stream, losing neither speed nor coherence for dozens of meters ahead of her. To a sensor, it would read not as the movement of a person across the lawn, but as a breeze. Heat. That would be the trickiest part. If she radiated heat, infrared sensors would inevitably pick it up. She surrounded herself with another bubble, this one of containment, and immediately felt her temperature begin to rise as the heat she expended stayed within centimeters of her skin. She could even control herself to the point that she did not sweat, and would need to do so here, but that too would increase her internal temperature. She stepped forward, concentrating on the act of walking, reminding herself that the movement of her legs was only a comforting paradigm. Levitating in some other pose would require more of her attention. Each step felt a bit wobbly, as though she were moving across a flexible playground surface, but she fell into a regular pace and let her muscle memory do the work for her. Mara bumped her nose into something hard and stopped. Immediately ahead of her was uniform grayness. She looked up along the curved surface of the bunker wall, and only a Jedi master is likely to become so focused that she walks into a wall, she told herself. She swayed where she stood, suddenly dizzy from the heat. Come on, Tew, she thought. You should have detected me by now. A cord, millimeters thick, transparent and almost invisible in the darkness, fell across her face. Hurriedly, she grasped at it, wrapped it around her waist three times, and gave it a tug. It hauled at her, and she walked up the wall, her arms trembling and legs increasingly faltering as the heat threatened to overwhelm her. An eternity later, she was 10 meters up the wall, and a wedge-shaped slit in the duracrete surface beckoned her. She stepped into darkness, dropped a meter to a hard floor, and landed badly, collapsing to the floor as her legs failed. She released the heat entrapment and felt the built-up energy flow away from her. With her last bit of strength, she held her control over the surrounding air long enough to send much of that heat streaming out through the slit in the wall, even as the slit slid closed. And then she burst into a sweat, a sudden head-to-toe sheen that felt like heavy motor oil against her skin. In the darkness, a female voice said, "Goodness, you smell like a rancor after a foot race." Mara smiled weakly. "That's no way to greet a master." There was a click, and brilliant light from overhead blinded Mara. She raised an arm over her eyes. As her vision settled, she could see she was in a tight chamber, narrower against the bunker exterior wall, but long. It was dominated by a neutral blue flying craft, a tubular vehicle like a starfighter, but with abbreviated fins instead of maneuvering wings. Its canopy, which opened at the rear instead of forward, was up. At the far end of the chamber, beside a circular hatch a meter in diameter, stood Tew Zax, with her hand on a control panel mounted on the wall. Short of stature, she stood a centimeter shorter than Leia, and was lean like most of her kind. She had pale blue skin, hair so pale that it seemed translucent, and delicate features dominated by eyes that seemed oversized. Mara struggled to a sitting position. Though tired and still flushed with heat, she felt much better already. "What is this place?"
"A secret escape chamber."
Tew came forward and reached up into the vehicle's cockpit, pressing dashboard controls without looking.
"I think there are 4 of them in this building, but I haven't gotten at all of them. The entry is concealed on the other side. This and the other one I found both had 2-person escape vehicles in them."
2 YVH combat droids led Han and Leia along the curved hallway. Only a third of the glow rods in the ceiling were activated, and the shadows in the hallway were deep. Most of the doors from the hall were on the right wall. An occasional door or side passage led away to the left. Marching in lockstep unison, the droids came to a halt before one of the right-hand doors. One of them gestured at it, doubtless transmitting a security code, and it slid up. The droids waited. Leia and Han exchanged a look. Han shrugged, and they entered. The chamber beyond was spacious and airy. The far wall was mostly transparasteel. Looking down on a larger chamber from the doorway, Han and Leia could see the far wall, but not the floor of that chamber. That chamber seemed to be circular and ringed by viewing chambers like this one.
It was dimly lit, like the hallway. The chamber they stood in was completely unlit. Its only illumination came in through the transparisteel wall and the door, and the latter source of light vanished as the door slid closed behind them. There were chairs and couches scattered throughout the chamber, including a line of high-backed swivel chairs set against the transparisteel wall, and one of them now rotated so that its occupant faced Han and Leia. It was a male human. The dimness made it difficult to make out the man's features, but he seemed to be dark-haired, with handsome but rather bland features. He rose.
"Captain Solo, Princess Organa, I'm glad to meet you at last."
Han and Leia approached and shook hands with him in turn.
"Prime Minister Tepler," Leia said. "Thank you for seeing us, and allow us to offer our condolences on your loss."
"Loss is, actually," Tepler corrected. "My brother died defending Adel."
"I apologize," Leia said. "We didn't know."
"I shouldn't have mentioned it," Tepler said. "Please, sit." He gestured to chairs opposite his and resumed his seat. His visitors settled into chairs.
Leia said, "We were surprised to receive your coded communication."
"Surprised that Adel had shared her secrets with me, as we were no longer husband and wife?" Leia nodded. "Well, she didn't. Not exactly."
Even in the poor light, Tepler seemed to lose his focus, his intensity, and Leia felt the man was staring back through time.
"After she died, I received an in-case-of-my-death package from her. Her dealings with you were part of that package. Also part of it was an apology for getting me killed." Han frowned.
"She hasn't, has she?"
"Not yet. And I'm likely to remain alive as long as certain parties see me as an asset rather than a liability." Tepler shrugged. "I'd like to remain alive. I prefer that even to coordinating Corellian government. But most of all, I want to keep Corellia from being ruined, devastated by war. Her economy depleted by a lengthy struggle against the Galactic Alliance. Or perhaps worst of all, her economy and critical faculties drained away by years of rule under the wrong regime." The Solos nodded. Tepler was obviously speaking of Chief Sal Solo and his political allies.
"And that's why I've asked you here," Tepler continued. "To defend my people, my world, I'm going to commit an act of high treason. I've smuggled you in here, into the most secure portions of our War Department facilities, so you can be a witness to a meeting I'm forbidden to attend."
Leia arched a brow.
"Why do you think I'd refrain from telling the GA military about the plans we listened to?"
The Prime Minister gave her a sad stare. "Because you know as well as I do that there can't be a peace initiative until the GA is off Trallis. The GA can't negotiate the departure because that's already been tried and failed. The GA can't just leave because it would be too great a loss of face, even greater than being driven off because it suggests they were wrong in the first place. And the Corellians won't even start thinking about peaceful solutions while there's an occupying force on Trallis."
His expression graduated from sad to positively miserable.
"There can't be peace until an act of war drives the GA out of this system, and you know it. And if you were to tell the GA government our plans, we couldn't succeed at driving them out. It's as simple as that."
Leia was silent for a long moment. Finally she said, "I've underestimated you, Prime Minister. You're more calculating than I thought."
"Aren't I, though?" Tepler rose, and the Solos did as well. "My droids will be back for you when it's safe to smuggle you out of here. In the meantime, the polarizing tint on the viewport here and the darkness of this chamber will prevent anyone below from seeing you."
"Meaning we shouldn't turn on the lights," Han said deadpan.
Tepler stared at him a long moment, then managed a slight smile. "Meaning exactly that."
Once she was set up before the computer console in Thrakken's quarters, it took Mara just short of 3 minutes to crack his security.
"Now, let's go prowling," she said.
And prowl she did, downloading everything she looked at into her own datapad. Not that it amounted to much.
"He apparently forwards all his files and records to a system in the government halls," she complained.
"He's very tidy. Not good for us."
"So this was all for nothing?"
Q's serene Jedi mask cracked for just a moment.
"All those days of terrible spicy Corellian food?"
Mara grinned.
Maybe not for nothing. We just need to look farther afield. She found security procedures and passwords that would make subsequent departures from and entries into this building much easier. Until they were changed, that is. She found poorly hidden personal files kept on the building's computer system by its security operatives, many of them constituting blackmail evidence against fellow agents, private citizens, and low-level government officials. And then she found what she was looking for, an incoming message from several days earlier. "To Thrakken Sal Solo, Chief of State, Corellia, all greetings and respects," she read. "Let me begin this communication by offering you a gift, the gift of knowledge. The impending meeting between representatives of the Corellian and Galactic Alliance governments will take place on Toryaz Station, Kuat System. But sadly, this gift is incomplete by itself, as security at the station will be formidable. Fortunately, I have information on that matter too. I can provide exact details on the locations of all delegates at all times, as well as the security measures guarding them for the duration of their stay here."
"Here," Tiu repeated. "So whoever wrote him was already on Toryaz Station?"
"Not necessarily. The word choice could be deliberate, to convince Thrakken of just that detail.
Should this information be of interest to you, please contact me on the holonet frequency indicated below, at the time shown. Standard encryption, using the contents of my next message as the encryption key. Then there's the time and frequency information."
"No name?"
"No name."
Mara scanned the file listing for follow-up messages with the same characteristics as this one.
"I'm not seeing any sign of the message with the encryption key. It was probably delivered by other means."
"I'm not feeling any animosity toward the sender of that message."
"You're not?" Mara looked up at you, surprised.
"No, so it's all right for me to kill him, correct?"
Mara grinned. "Self-deception is always a bad idea to you."
"Except when it amuses a Jedi Master."
"Well, true."
Tiu sobered.
"But the fact that Thrakken received this message doesn't mean that he paid for that information. He isn't necessarily the one responsible for the attack."
"Yes, he is," Mara said. "Regardless of whether he received the second information and dispatched the killers, not reporting it to Korsak and Prime Minister Saxon constitutes treason, betrayal. Whether he arranged for assassins or just sat on information, he's at least partly to blame for Saxon's death and the mess we're in."
"Oh,"
Tiu brightened.
"Well then, I'm not feeling animosity toward him either. Can I?"
"No." Mara glanced up as though she could see through intervening floors into the chamber by which she'd entered the bunker.
"That escape craft, is it hyperdrive equipped?"
"It is," Tiu replied.
Half an hour after Prime Minister Tepler's departure, politicians and military officers began entering the room beneath Tepler's viewing chamber. They traveled in groups, one important dignitary, backed by 3 to 5 members of support staff, with the dignitary and one aide seating themselves at the large triangular table dominating the room. The others exiled to secondary tables or far corners, there to remain until summoned. As these people spoke in their small groups, Han and Leia could occasionally make out their words, whenever they were projected across the table or the room. Soon enough, Han realized that they were being augmented by a set of speakers in the wall beneath the long viewport. Eventually, the highest-ranking officer so far, Admiral Vera Karathis, Chief of Staff for the Ministry of War and operational leader of the Corellian military, entered with her retinue. All the other officers straightened, looking busier and more efficient, and the big chamber's upper lights came on in full strength. Standing at one truncated point at the triangular table, Karathis pointedly drew a chrono out of a jacket pocket and consulted it. As she did so, several of the other officers glanced in the direction of Tepler's box, beneath it, actually, and a trifle to the left, and exchanged eye contact and words with one another, reacting to some new arrival and indicating that at last things might proceed. From the direction they had been looking, Wedge Antilles, again in Corellian uniform, walked into the room, without retinue. Admiral Karathis gave Wedge a wan smile.
"Cutting it rather close, aren't you, Antilles?"
Wedge nodded and moved up to the table beside Karathis.
"Admiral, if I had a credit for every time someone told me that, Yes, you could probably buy our way out of this situation.
Carathis looked up, in a direction disconcertingly close to where Han and Leia sat, but her eyes seemed to be focused on a point to their left, beyond the wall that separated them from the next room.
Are we all ready? Yes? Then let's begin. Please, sit.
She did as she suggested, and there was a momentary delay as some officers fled the main table and others trotted up to it, seating themselves.
All right,
Carathis said.
We find ourselves in the unenviable, unacceptable, but unavoidable position of having to wage a battle against enemy forces occupying the center of one of our own cities. We cannot do this without a gruesome toll in the lives of our own people, which could very well swing public opinion against us, which would be increasingly harmful to our defense of the Corellian system. Nor can we just ignore the enemy beachhead, as leaving it intact will allow them to reinforce it, expand it, and begin bringing more and more potent offenses against our in-system positions. Their command post in Reladir on Trollis has to be obliterated, and so Operation Noble Savage has been designed to obliterate it, and to turn what would be public opinion disaster into an asset.
Han and Leia shiver. He gave her a questioning look.
She didn't say anything about minimizing expected civilian deaths, she said.
Han leaned forward to give Carathis a closer look.
Maybe she's getting to that.
Maybe.
Below, Carathis gestured to someone out in the shadows along the big room's walls. A hologram sprang into existence above the center of the table, a view of the center of the city of Reladir, inverted so that those at the table looking up were actually looking down into the monolithic block of skyscrapers as if from a great height. The disc-shaped hologram began a slow rotation, and then a large region at the center of it, a massive circular white building with 8 narrowing points around its rim, giving it the appearance of a royal crown, began blinking red, white, red, white. The building was easy to make out among all the skyscrapers, as it was surrounded by a broad belt of green, occasionally decorated with narrow gray lines, a large city park with foot trails tracing through it. Carathis continued.
This is their command post. They've occupied the Naval Center for the Performing Arts. This was a very good choice, speaking from a military point of view. It's commodious, has an extensive underground storage area not accessible through any of the city's normal underground infrastructure, and commands a good view of the surrounding airspace. It's also sound strategically, because the center is right in the heart of one of the most densely occupied portions of central Reladir. Any standard action waged there will result in thousands of civilian casualties. One concussion missile missing its target could bring down an entire superhabitat building. And inevitably, there will be missiles missing their targets. Many of them. Our grim task has been to turn that terrible but inevitable consequence of war to our advantage. However, despite their good choices, the GA has made some poor ones, too. Situating several starfighter squadrons and some planet-landable fighting vessels around their command post as a show of strength gives us more things to destroy, explosively, catastrophically, and most important, recordably, when we do hit that site.
This is bad, 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 Han said.
He couldn't keep an edge of anger out of his voice. The wire grid shield indicators began blinking more erratically.
In the first part of our operation, teams of commandos will be infiltrated into Reladir. They will attempt to reach the shield generators and destroy them with high explosives. Success on their part is to be considered a bonus to our plan, but the plan does not rely on it.
On the upside-down view of Reladir, half a dozen green dots appeared at various points along the view's rim and sped toward the enemy command post, each followed by a stream of red dots.
In the second part of the operation, Corellian YT-5100 Shriek-class bombers will assault the shielded region from all sides, closely pursued by Galactic Alliance starfighters and warships. They will bombard the shields, if any survive, and then continue their bombardment of the command post until it is destroyed. The Shriek-class bombers have been chosen because they are distinctly, uniquely, unmistakably Corellian. Designed by the Corellian Engineering Corporation, they have not entered full production yet. Only 10 late-model prototypes and a few earlier prototypes are in existence. The pursuing spacecraft, though bearing the colors and insignia of vehicles and vessels of the Galactic Alliance fleet, will actually be units of the Corellian Defense Force. Instead of shooting down the Shrieks, other than hitting them with a few reduced-strength laser blasts for cosmetic effect, their mission will be to reinforce the firepower of those bombers, and to reassign blame for civilian deaths to the Galactic Alliance.
Silence fell in the wake of the Admiral's words. Leia put her face into her hands, not an expression of grief, but a way to keep her composure. Han took a long, deep breath. It had gotten worse. Wedge turned a brilliant, bitter smile on the Admiral.
It would seem that the plan would actually benefit if we maximize civilian casualties.
Leia lifted her head, her eyes wide. Admiral Carathis's face relaxed into a non-expression, as though she'd just been hit by a blaster set to stun.
General Antilles, that might be the most callous thing I've ever heard you say.
Wedge looked scornful and made a dismissive gesture.
Admiral, let's call a skifter a skifter. Operation Noble Savage is, as you yourself said, designed to take what is inevitably going to be a public relations nightmare, the deaths of thousands of civilians from friendly fire, and turn it to the advantage of the Corellian independence cause. It will take outrage that would have been directed against us and turn it against our opponents. That outrage will stiffen Corellian resistance against the GA, allowing us to hit harder, more ferociously. By an inevitable progression of logic, the more horrible the offense we can blame on the GA forces, the greater that outrage. Correct?
Carathis blinked.
General, I'm within seconds of ordering you to shut up and leave this council. That would be a mistake,
Wedge said.
If you did that, you'd prevent me from showing you how to achieve your military objectives without wantonly killing fellow Corellians.
Carathis paused. A square of light fell across the table as another of the observation rooms was illuminated from within. Its occupant had obviously turned on its interior light so as to be seen from below. Han and Leia looked around the bank of observation booths, but none they could see was now illuminated, meaning that the one they were looking for had to be close to theirs. Then a voice, electronically amplified, boomed from the room just to their left.
General, am I to understand that the operation I helped design, that I approved and am ready to set into motion, is wanton?
Leia winced, and Han felt like drawing his blaster. That cutting voice was distinctive, instantly recognizable. It was Thrakken Sal Solo. Wedge turned to face Sal Solo's viewport, meaning he was staring almost directly up into Han and Leia's as well.
No, sir. As I'm sure your protocol droid is now telling you, my use of the word wanton referred to the unnecessary deaths of so many of our kinfolk and fellow citizens. And there's the additional factor that while this group might be able to maintain for years the terrible secret that we were responsible for those deaths, we wouldn't be able to keep it forever. Secrets like hydraulic fluids have a nasty habit of seeping out into the open, just when it's worse for everybody.
Sal Solo's voice boomed again.
Was that a threat, Antilles?
Wedge made a dismissive gesture Han knew would have to outrage Sal Solo.
No, it was a realistic appraisal, and my realistic appraisal of Operation Noble Savage suggests to me that it would be effective and that it would probably succeed, but that it would not be efficient. To be efficient, it would have to accomplish our goals with minimal loss of civilian life, and with a chance to reduce, instead of increase, our chance to enter a full-scale shooting war.
And can you do all that, General, and put a shine on your reputation while you're at it?
I can, and put a shine on your reputation.
Let's hear it,
Sal Solo said.
If I like what I hear, you might not find yourself begging on a street corner come morning.
Wedge turned his back on the man's booth. From a breast pocket, he removed a data pad. Looking around, he apparently spotted the room's hologram input sensor. He pointed the data pad at it, and abruptly the hologram image overhead changed. Once again, it was the center of Relidir, but a less realistic plotting of it. The skyscrapers were all simple gray rectangles, their windows, balconies, and decorations not represented. A moment after the hologram resolved into crisp detail, dome-like translucences in pink appeared to show the two sets of shields maintained by the Galactic Alliance occupiers.
Same problem, different solution,
Wedge said. On the hologram, two flights of green blips, six blips per flight, two half squadrons, appeared at the edges of the displayed region. The first from one angle, and the second from an angle 90 degrees to that of the first. The first flight overflew the shield-protected region. A moment later, the second flight followed suit. Now red dots appeared on the display, in numbers rapidly swelling from 20 to 100, and formed up to follow the green dots. Both the pursued and the pursuers exited the scene within moments. Wedge continued.
Stage 1 is a diversionary bombing run on the shields. Standard operational procedure to overload shields and bring them down. Given that the GA occupiers have not only installed military power generators at the site, but also commandeered city power generators and can feed them straight into their shields, the shields possess a lot of power. This run will fail, and the bombers will make a quick bounce up to orbit, drawing off a certain amount of pursuit.
Wedge tapped another button on his data pad. Just barely within the outer perimeter of the shields, a massive gray building began to blink in color, alternating between green and yellow.
This is the Tercury Housing Complex, currently under construction, being built on the site of an old complex that had to be deconstructed for safety reasons. The new complex will be somewhat more upscale than many of the surrounding housing units, providing modern amenities and a broad underground hangar area for private skimmers, shuttles, and the like.
Sal Solo's voice was richly mocking.
You almost make me want to live there. At the moment, sir, it's not a very good investment. Stage 2 of this operation involves taking a couple of those Shriek-class bombers and flying them clean through the Tercury housing complex, then continuing on to the Arts Center and initiating its destruction.
The angle of the schematic changed, dropping the point of view until it was oriented mere meters over a broad thoroughfare. At the far end of the thoroughfare was the blinking green and yellow building.
I mentioned the housing complex's broad underground hangar.
The hologram's point of view went into motion, traveling toward the blinking building at a high rate of speed.
Here you can see a simulation of the Shriek bombers' approach toward the housing complex. When they get to the distance of a few blocks, they release some of their ordnance.
Blue dotted lines leapt forward toward the blinking building, but dropped at the last moment to strike the thoroughfare just ahead of it.
And blow a broad hole in the avenue, straight down into the hangar area. They fly through the hangar, blowing out an exit ahead of them, and emerge through that hole on the far side, then continue on to their target. As they approach their target, they release their payload of targeter droids, rather crude droids used by our armed forces to teach sharpshooting and ballistics. Those droids use laser rangefinders and other sensors to paint their target, defining not just the command center, but a precise point on its shielding.
And then?
Finally, Sal Solo sounded interested rather than mocking.
And then the hundreds of missiles fired in the wake of the two Shrieks, following the telemetry sent by those targeter droids, come pouring out of the hangar bay, hit that point on the shields, overload them until they fail, and continue on to hit the command post, plus the vehicles and vessels on the ground, surgically eradicating them. Let me make sure I understand,
Sal Solo said.
Your two Shriek bombers, they'll be sustaining fire from any GA defenses not drawn off by our diversion.
Correct, Wedge said.
That means gunships, starfighters, anti-spacecraft gun emplacements, and who knows what else.
Correct.
How do they do this?
Well, Wedge said.
First, the performance characteristics of the Shrieks are known to the GA government. But since the bombers aren't in production yet, that information hasn't been widely distributed. It's not likely to be in the databases of the GA forces around Tralis. This means the defenders won't know exactly what to expect from these machines. Second, the fact that the assault force seems inadequate to the task means the forces arrayed against the Shrieks will probably not be overwhelming. And third, I plan to choose, assuming I'm selected to implement this plan. Otherwise, I'll just recommend pilots who are especially well-suited to this sort of mission. I don't mean the pilots who've been testing the Shrieks, good men and women though they are. I mean canny old veterans who have decades of experience with YT-series spacecraft. Pilots familiar with terrain-following assaults and other seemingly suicidal flying techniques.
Han leaned farther forward, almost pressing his forehead against the transperisteel, his attention fixed on Wedge. He heard Leia whisper,
Oh, no.
Thraken, sounding cheerful, boomed,
"Admiral Carathis, I think this plan deserves close scrutiny."
Co-opt system, Toyaz Station.
Jason sat in the rolling chair with his feet up on the desk before him. He knew that the image he was holocasting would show his boot soles up close, the rest of his seated body at a slightly greater distance, and then Ben solemnly standing behind his chair. Jason held the grouping of tassels up before him and studied it. All of it?
I don't know. I can only speak for the one at the very bottom. It's like writing,
the Twi'lek said.
A pattern of knots, so individualized, so specific that they can carry thoughts the way writing does. I actually had to take the highest detail holocam scan you sent me of it and run it through a sculpture interpreter, generating a three-dimensional replica in a flexible material before I could interpret it. It must be held, manipulated by touch in order for its meaning to become clear.
And its meaning is what?
As close as I can translate it into basic, it means he will strengthen himself through pain.
Jason gave the Twi'lek a close look.
You look startled, Master Solo.
Jason shook his head. I'm not a master, just a Jedi Knight, for Ollie. I apologize if I led you to believe that you're speaking with a social equal.
I do not think in such segregated terms, Jedi Solo.
As for my startlement, that phrase has echoes of an old Jedi saying, "There is no pain where strength lies." Could it actually be translated that way? For Ollie shook his head, the gesture deliberate and artificial.
No. It is closest to, he will strengthen himself through pain.
And you can't read any of the others?
No, they are not Twi'lek.
Jason considered. So, these other tassels, could they still be the same sort of item? A form of writing?
Yes, or I think several. They are distinct in the ways they were made, each fabricated through a different technique. I suspect it means that, if they all convey messages, each does so through a different method of communication, perhaps from a different world or culture altogether.
Jason gave him a smile. I know this is going to sound lazy.
But is there a central source of knowledge that might be able to decode all of them?
You're very good at mind reading, Farali. Are you Force-sensitive?
No, I am merely well acquainted with academic laziness.
The Twi'lek considered.
I would recommend the World of Lord. It is a repository of academic knowledge, and its people, like my own, have developed a greater facility with nonverbal communication than most. Perhaps it wouldn't prove the odds that they have concentrated knowledge in this field. But you must take the item there.
Jason nodded. Just what I wanted to know. Thank you, and goodbye.
Farewell.
Jason leaned forward to punch the disconnect button, and the hologram of the Twi'lek faded from view. Jason relaxed back into his chair and sat for long moments, studying the bottom tassel.
So we're going to Lord? Ben asked.
We're going to Lord. Go pack.
Coronet Corellia.
The war conference room was almost empty. Wedge Antilles shook hands with Admiral Carathis and her aides, then watched them depart the chamber. He began fiddling with his data pad.
We do need to wait for the YVH droids to come back for us, Leia said.
I know that, Han protested. I wasn't planning on popping out into the corridor while Thrakken's security team waits out there.
Well, you looked impatient.
Han tried to force himself to look less impatient.
Don't volunteer, Leia said.
Huh? For what?
For Wedge's plan.
I have to, Leia.
That mission was made for me.
General Antilles.
It was Thraken's voice again, still booming from the next observation room. Below, Wedge glanced up again.
Sir, I have a favor to ask of you, as Minister of War. Something that's distinctly in your patriotic duty to do. Something you really should have done by now.
Thraken's tone was pleasant, not at all urgent. Wedge returned his attention to his data pad.
Let's hear it.
You have a daughter serving with the Galactic Alliance Armed Forces under the name of Lysa Dunter. She's assigned to the force occupying